Today on the Bird Gang Powerlifting Podcast.
We just get better every single offseason.
83 kilogram world champ Joe Bornstein.
I'm gonna need like 930 and I believe I can reach that.
And his coach Luke.
Just intuitive forward level thinking.
The Elite is our English series where we interview world level coaches and lifters.
That's what makes Joey and I unique.
I'll give some free keys out right now. Exactly what we're doing.
We are pushing him and obviously winning.
Ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome to a new episode of the Bird Gang Powerlifting Podcast. My name is Falk. I'm here with my lovely co-host, Maximilian Rabe. And we are joined by the one and only world champ of the 83s, Mr. Joe Bornstein, and his coach, Luke. How are you guys doing?
Doing great. I appreciate you for inviting us on.
Yeah, likewise. Doing good.
Really hyped to have you here on the podcast. Another episode of The Elite. We've already had a few guys from the top end of the world, such as Steve DeNovi, Pavel Jurczynski, or Marcellus. And now today, we're joined by the rising star of powerlifting. You just recently took home the gold medal for the 83s in our home base, pretty much, in Chemnitz, Germany. I've talked to Luke in advance. How was the journey to Chemnitz for you guys?
It was pretty lengthy. Like, the plane ride itself was almost 10 hours because I landed in Frankfurt. And then my boy, he's also an athlete, he's from Belgium. So we drove from Belgium to Frankfurt all the way to Chemnitz, which was another like 7 hour drive with all the stops and bathroom breaks. So I was traveling for a good like 17 hours from plane to car, but we made it. We came safe. I was eating throughout the entire time. So I think we optimized the variables at hand.
That's good.
But I'm glad to hear you took the car, because usually Germany is famous for its good transportation system. But I think that was not the case this year.
Yeah, you were lucky.
No, I was going to take the car. Yeah. Well, he offered to just drive me, and then I didn't want to rent a car either. That would just be like a waste of money, in my opinion, because everything was walkable. But he offered to drive me and just take me around all the stops, like going to the grocery store or getting my equipment checked in, taking to the venue and all that. So I couldn't let him up on an offer. It was a deal I couldn't refuse. So I agreed to it. And he was super helpful. His name is Jorne.
Shout out, my man.
I could definitely not do any of this without him, because I would have been stranded at my hotel or taking way too many steps trying to get to that venue. So without him, yeah, it would have been a mess.
Yeah, shout out Jorne, bro.
And which hotel did he stay?
He stayed in Airbnb. I stayed in the CO 56, I believe.
Yeah.
So I was able to actually, I meal prepped all my food at his Airbnb as well. Nice. So I was able to eat healthy and track my macros and everything. And he also speaks a little bit of German. So he helped translate and read the labels and everything. So
yeah, nice. So also a win for him, I would say.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. How was the German crowd for you guys? So how was to experience the event?
It was great. I guess going back to the travel part, I had an overnight layover. So I flew to Washington, D.C., and then my flight got delayed from Indy to D.C., so I ended up missing my connecting flight from D.C. to Frankfurt. So I had an overnight layover, but luckily I knew somebody in the area who was generous enough to let me stay at their place, and then I eventually woke up in the morning and got on my flight. So it was just like super drug out. But once I got to Germany, it was nice. Like, the food was really good. But yeah, like, the people were really nice. One thing I was surprised about, though, was how little people actually spoke English, like for like the actual German people.
Oh, wow.
Because I had already been to Berlin, and like pretty much everyone there spoke English. So it was really surprising to me that like people in Chemnitz really, they didn't know like any English at all. So
yeah. Can relate.
I don't want to tell you what Chemnitz is famous for, but yeah, definitely not the
well-spoken English
most showable town of Germany, I think.
Yeah.
But I was happy about the German crowd. They really cheered everybody on, and
they did.
I think it was great to watch.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they're definitely all supportive. They're the chants, the screams, especially for who was the 74? That was getting crazy. Nick Wright.
Josh.
Nick Wright
is.
Oh, Joshua Wright. Nick Wright's a commentator. Joshua Wright. Yeah, the crowd for him was insane. So definitely a highly supportive crowd, great people. Where were those people from? All from Chemnitz, or were they coming from like Berlin, Frankfurt, Leipzig?
No, from all over Germany. So people from every city came down. It was the big powerlifting event, obviously. I mean, it's Worlds. And a lot of our athletes also came down from the northern end of Germany or from the southwest. I was attending Worlds as a coach for the last 2 or 3 years. And to my experience, this was the gold standard of cheering on people.
Yeah, most definitely.
Yeah, we definitely felt the love, so.
One funny story I have to share. Usually at the powerlifting event, there are not so many people who drink beer. But I myself quite enjoy a beer or two. And I wasn't sure to get one. Was sitting there, and nobody was drinking something. But then, two rows ahead of me, the world champ, Joe Borenstein himself, was sitting down with a big cup of beer. And then I thought, okay, that must be the sign.
Yeah, right in that moment, he stood up.
Yeah, my wife got me a beer. Yeah, I asked her to pick me a beer when she went to the bathroom, so she brought one. It was the first beer I had in like 9 months, so like it was well deserved. It was well deserved beer for me.
Yeah, for sure.
What was your plan going into Worlds? I mean, you hit 900 at Nationals. Mm-hmm. Was your plan to improve on that or to see how everybody else was doing?
Yeah, so the initial plan was to continue to improve on it. Because if you look at my block beforehand, like right after Nationals, only 4.5 weeks later, I did 870 kilos for reps. So that block right there was objectively stronger than the block before Nationals, mm-hmm. and probably stronger than my National day itself. Like the day I did the 870, I did like 295 double on squat, which is an all-time PR, 10 kilos under my meat PR. So I was for sure good for 307, 310, right? Bench, I hit 215. I smoked 215 for a fatigue single. My meet best is 218. And then I took 360 for a deadlift double that day, which is a PR as well. And my meet best was 377. So one block after that, I was stronger than ever again. So I was like, oh shit, I'm good to progress even more. Push to like 907 and a half, maybe 910, because 907 is 2,000 pounds in total, or in 2,000 pounds, yeah, in US pounds total. So that was the goal. I want to be the first to cross the 2,000 pound barrier, but I got sick 2 weeks out. Pretty sick.
Oh shit.
I couldn't sleep at all. I don't know what was wrong. Like I couldn't breathe through my nose. So I was like mouth breathing for like a week straight. And I couldn't sleep because of that. I was sleeping like, I usually go like 9 to 10 hours of sleep a night. I went from 9 to 10 to like 5 to 6 maybe. So for a whole week straight, I was getting barely any sleep. And I was sick on top of that, like I said, and I was dropping body weight. So from my week 3 SPD, that's the day I got sick, to my week 4 SPD, I still was sick. Not as severely, but I was still feeling the lingering effects. So I was basically sick for a week straight. Recovery was shit. And that's why my last 2 SPD sessions were overshot like crazy. So we tapered pretty hard. And we showed up to meet day stronger than I expected. So I was pretty happy with the performance. I didn't think 910 was there to win anyways. Like I think like 890, 900 was the winning total. And it ended up being 890 on that lower end. But the plan was to go over 9, secure a PR again. But it is what it is. I'm not mad about how it performed because we milked out every fucking kilo, right? I probably didn't have 2.5 kilos more on any lift. So whatever happened on the day, let's say Ade did pull his third, like I would have been satisfied with the result simply because I couldn't have done more. I did everything in my power to leave it all out there on the platform. So I'm just lucky he dropped his last deadlift, or last 2 deadlifts in this case. So
sure. Talking about yeah, Adi.
No one was thinking he's going to lift it off the floor, and we were very surprised when he pulled it up to like right before lockout.
I was surprised too.
It was surprising. And definitely a good call to get every kilo.
I didn't expect it either. I was expecting it to like maybe get to his knees at most, but it looked like it moved faster from the floor past his knees compared to the second attempt. So I was really confident at first. Like I was like, all right, this is in the bag. But then he smokes it. My heart drops. And then he drops the bar. And I'm like, oh, fuck, I win. So it was an amazing experience. I was so hyped. But I wasn't nervous before the lift. I got nervous during the lift. So definitely exciting.
Yeah, talking about your program. You guys are pretty famous for planning the whole macro and all the cycles within it. What's the process to get there, to sit down and think straight about which numbers are we going to hit? How is the block structured? How do you manage to think this far ahead and structure all through?
Yeah, so I think like that's kind of what makes Joey and I unique, is our ability to kind of strategize so far out. But I mean, we've done it for so long, like, so we have so much data. And so we can kind of just sit down, we'll call each other for 2-3 hours. We'll sit down and we'll do probably 2 or 3 macro cycles worth of programming. And each macro cycle is roughly like at least 3 or 4 blocks. We like to just program up to the meat, and we know it works, so we can kind of just fill in the gaps. But I think you had Marcellus on here a little while ago, and he was like, it's not about where you start, it's about where you finish. So we always try and work backwards. So we'll like, we'll put down our goals. We know like a block out, we want to hit singles, and then like 2 blocks out, we want to hit doubles on the top set, and then like 3 blocks out, we want to hit triples. And then from there, we kind of just go based off of where like we can improve on our weaknesses. So like, for instance, this last macro cycle was only 2 blocks because it was from Nats to Worlds. And we like, for instance, an example would be like we push our secondary deadlift a little bit too much because we used too little of a comp of a load limiting variation in like pause deadlifts, and we did too little of reps. We did 5 reps, and so like his peak deadlift intensity on that secondary day was, you know, it was infringing upon his primary deadlift day, and then that was driving down his strength. So like one change we were able to make this time around is to definitely stay away from that high intensity on that secondary day, and switch also to a more load limiting variation like beltless deadlifts. Do higher rep ranges to even like limit the load further, and then also refine that technique so that he's very proficient on that primary day. But it's just kind of like stuff like that, just intuitive forward level thinking that kind of, you know, drives us to be able to complete these macro cycles so far out in advance.
And talking about variations, we think when we watch your programming and all your lifts over the macro cycle, it seems like you've
studied everything.
A little bit of investigating there. Mm-hmm. And it looked like you're choosing variations that are getting more and more specific to the meet. Is it right?
Yeah. So we basically trade relative intensity for absolute intensity getting close to the meet, especially on the secondaries.
And we also noticed that you are doing the same week-to-week jumps, no matter if you are pushing triples, doubles, or singles. Does it have worked for you in the past?
Yeah, I mean, we change them around a little bit, but we like to stick to like the bigger jumps. We like to stick to what we know works. Obviously, there is room for a little bit of refinement in there, and obviously, the jumps aren't the same on each day. Like, for instance, a secondary bench day will have different jumps compared to a primary bench day. But yeah, we've definitely found the types of jumps that work well for Joe. Like, for instance, we like to take very big jumps on deadlift, just because he fatigues very quickly with higher intensity on the primary. So like weeks 1-3, we stay pretty much like between the RP 4 to 6 to 7 range. And then that allows him to be fully recovered for the week 4, and then the quick turnaround into the deload the following week.
In terms of your deadlifts, Joe, we noticed that it was 25 kg jumps from week to week, right? And these are pretty big jumps, as you said, Luke. But how did you manage to get there? Like, Joe, what did you monitor or give in terms of feedback to Luke to see 25 kg jumps from week to week are the thing we have to do?
So I think it's more so just feeling the fatigue out on a certain day, like on week 1, and always having a goal at hand. So for example, like Luke said, we backtrack from that week 4, or even we backtrack at the end of a macro, right? But in this case, we're talking about the micro or the meso. So in that meso, we'll go to the week 4. Let's say I want 380 kilo on deadlift, for example. But on week 1, I'm feeling trashed. I'm not going to force the week 1 and try to just maintain those 25 kilo jumps or 20 kilo jumps. So in this case, I'll go even lighter. I'll start with like, I've started at low as 275 and worked my way up to 380. So in these cases, I'll take the week 1 to 2 jump a little bit bigger, just so I can cover that spread and not make the later jumps, you know, as big or not enough where I won't be primed from the previous week. But week one to two really doesn't matter. I know I'm going to feel like shit regardless. So I might as well sandbag it and get as much recovery in as possible. So it's more so just feeling how good I'll, or mapping out the fatigue patterns from week one to two. And then two to three, I want to prime myself and get ready for the week four. So that jump will be a little more moderate. And then week three to four, I'll try to either match that jump or make a slightly bigger one. But it all depends. So it, if I'm doing like a triple, the jumps will be a little smaller because the absolute lows are obviously going to be a little smaller as well. So I believe when I did triples last time, I was taking 20s, but from week one to two, I did a 25. And then I try to just map that fatigue pattern and bring it to the next macro. So I'll do like, oh, I have doubles now. Now I know I can handle a 25, but let me try maybe a 30 because with doubles, the absolute intensity is a little higher there as well. So I'll try that 30 out. And when I go to singles, same thing applies. The absolute intensity of a single is going to be higher than a double and a triple. So I'm going to try the even bigger jump. So it all starts out at the beginning of the macro when you're taking these smaller low intensity weights. And then just try to mimic that and try to copy that fatigue pattern from macro to macro.
Another question that opens up for me there is like, we in our programming try to make week one of the block as, yeah, let's say underwhelming as possible. So you should just go into training and it should feel easy and then you can progress from there. And a lot of people have struggled with how they can get into week one being so light. And as you said, you doing your week one as light as possible as well, not to feel trashy. But is there any advice to deal with having a really light week one, like psychologically? So because so many people, from my point of view, are struggling with keeping week one pretty light.
I understand that for newer lifters. I definitely remember when I was like 18, 19 years old and I'd see the weight that Luke puts in the program and I'm like, I'm not taking that shit. I can hit this for like 10 reps. I'm not doing that, right? But over the course of my training development and the years that's passed, I look forward to week ones. I am so beat up. I'm like, I might go even lower than the range Luke puts in now. So I look forward to taking those light weights. It doesn't feel good when you're going so high intensity on a week four and then having that quick turnaround. So I think it just comes with maturing and realizing that you have to deload. You have to drop fatigue. You have to plummet that as much as possible. You have to physically and visually see the effects of doing that first to understand the benefits. You can't, if you're not listening to your coach, then why are you paying him, right? Like there's no point. So listen to your coach, at least do it for one or two blocks, see how it works. And then once you realize that, oh shit, this is actually a pretty smart idea. My coach knows what he's doing. Then maybe you should follow that and keep going, right? don't argue with the coach. I'm telling you, if you want to make up on some intensity, let's say you feel like a bitch by going 70% on the week one, just push that intensity, go to it, put it in the accessories, right? Do something with it if you want. But but you're not gonna progress more by taking more weight on that week one. It's not there. That's not the purpose of it. It's simply there to set you up for the remainder of 3 weeks.
Better be clear about it. I'm gonna clip that. I'm gonna send it out to everyone.
Yeah, please do. Please do.
I guess like one other thing I would add to that, like some little note would be like, you have to realize your training or your estimated one rep max on every lift changes every single day. And so like, that's the whole point of programming, is to set yourself up to where you can predict where you're going to be the strongest on one certain day. Like you're not going to be your strongest every single day. That's just impossible. Unless you're like some superhuman or whatever, but like, you can definitely set yourself up to program your body to, you know, really just kind of like teach your body to be strong on certain days. And that's the whole point of powerlifting coaching in the first place. And then also, I guess like if you wanted to have a little bit of help on the week ones, wave loading on the week four definitely helps. So if you don't want to feel as trash on the week one, and like wave loading volume on the week four will still allow you to have a very high intensity week four on like the primary SPD, if that's what you're doing. And then the following week on week one, you won't feel as trashed as well, just because of that volume reduction on the week four. So a couple of things to add.
Yeah. The wave load that's a game changer because it also peaks you for the week four primaries as well. So it's like a 2-in-1 combo. You're a little more fresh on that week one on the following week, but you're also getting a more peaking effect on your primaries on that with that week four. So also tapering the back downs on week four, that could help.
Yeah.
It's not recommended for everyone. Let's say you need the volume and intensities to progress, but If you don't and you notice that you're still too trashed after 1 week of deloading, then I would recommend, like Luke said, the wave load method. It is a cheat code, especially if you're doing 4 week blocks stuff.
Yeah, I really love it how you can came up with some concepts or ideas and then realize, oh, everybody else is also doing it or coming up with it on their own. And stuff like backend deloads, I was doing them. And then I think 3 months later, there was a video on Powerlifting Now. And I was thinking, yes, that's exactly what I tried. What are actually your main influences for your programming philosophy?
I'd say, well, at first it was a lot of like the strength guys. I know Luke was big on those guys when we were like 16, 17. And then it slowly started transitioning to like flex style programming with like the hyper specificity and like dropping accessories a bit, which is similar to strength guys as well. But we never ran like the super hyper specific singles year round and then 2x8, 3x8. Like we never ran that. But we were pretty specific in terms of just like comp squat only, for example. Like we ran like tertiary, secondary, and primary, all comp squat at one time. It didn't really work. My squat was stagnated for like 3-4 months. But recovery also wasn't the best at the time, so I can't just blame it on that. But yeah, it's just slowly transitioning and seeing like new arising coaches come into the space. So when I first started, like I said, strength guys and flex. Then we started hearing of, you know, Marcellus. Then Nori started popping off. And then Steve DeNovi. And then now we have all these different big name coaches that are big in the space and have their name out there and they're making great content. So just over the years, just being eager to learn and try to absorb as much knowledge. So if there's a new coach out there, I don't care if he has, you know, 10,000 followers, 100,000, 1,000, if they're giving good content out, I'm going to look at it. I'm not going to apply everything they say, but I'm going to try to assess it through my own lens and see if I can take some tools out from here and there and try to apply it to my training.
That's funny. I also started with a TSG mentorship back then, and some things didn't work as well, I would say. This was crazy how they talked about Taylor Atwood picking up with a lot of volume and already hitting crazy numbers 1 month out. And then they're just doing like singles and triples, and he was waking up with night pain every day. I was saying to myself, I don't know if this is how it should be and if this is the best strategy. But yeah, I think also they had changed a little bit of their approach. Is there other stuff you tried in the past or athletes where you were thinking, how can this work?
I look at Agatha's training and eight SBDs, like I only have one SBD a week. I couldn't imagine doing eight. Like even if I split up the intensity and volume, like to accumulate every single day to add up to what I have right now, I still wouldn't feel good. I don't know. It doesn't. That was the alien that Luke was talking about earlier. So you could probably be strong every single day. I'm not knowing me, I'm good for one day out of the entire month. So that's pretty much it.
I was listening to the Powerlifters Programming podcast recently. Is that where you were, Luke? And they've had an episode with Thomas Lilly from Australia, and they were talking about Agatha as well, and said something like, "Yeah, and now she's doing back the time. She's doing seven SBDs, but she can't do it for forever. And at one point, she needs to hurt herself, something like that." I was thinking that at this point, most people didn't really look at her program. I mean, it's not too easy to get there. But we've attended a seminar of Pavel, and I told Luke in advance we are pretty close friends with him as well. And he tried to give us more detailed insight on how he programs it. And it is pretty much, so when you narrow it down, it is a very evened out program where you just have hyper-specific exercises you do. So it's mostly squat, bench, and deadlift, right? But she's doing a lot of variations and a lot of super light work as well. So SBD day could be... two sets of three high bar squats at RPE 2, then doing post bench at a higher intensity, and then deadlift variations at RPE 5 to 6. So this is pretty much an SBD day. And I mean, yeah, doing 7 trainings a week is hardcore. I get that as well.
Bumped it to 8. She just bumped it to the 8th one.
Yeah, now she's doing 8 with having 2 SBD days on one day. I don't know if it's necessary. We will see how that plays out in the future, but it's well structured and not just only full front, foot to the gas all the time. It's very, very evened out and very thoughtful, I must say.
I think in the past you also did a lot of volume, probably much more than nowadays. Do you compensate in any way? For example, doing more reps on or more sets on accessories?
Not really. As I noticed, like the stronger I get, the less I need because those back downs just get so much more intense. So I went from, what was that? I remember one time I had a 6x7 on squat on my tertiary. And then I have like 5 sets in the primary and like 6 on the secondary. So I don't know if that's a shit ton of volumes, but now I have at most I'll do 4 sets on the primary and 3 on the secondary. And that's like absolute most. So 7 sets a week comparison to like 15 plus. But the absolute loads are so much higher than back then. Cause like back then I was like 18, 19 years old. So I was barely squatting like 230, 240. So yeah, I've noticed that the stronger I get, the less I need. And then I do still push my accessories like crazy. I actually have more energy now to push my accessories. So it's not like that I'm compensating the lack of volume. It's actually my body and mind can handle the accessory now. But before, I had 3 squat days, all those sets. I'd go in, I look at the program, I see belt squat. I'm like, nah, not today. I'm cooked. And I'll go home, you know? But like now, I'm like, okay, I got pendulum and I got BSS, right? I feel great. I didn't cook myself on squat. I'm going to go in and hit this. So I'm not compensating. It's just now I can actually handle it.
And also on your bench, I think a lot of people, even if they are stronger on total load, they do a shitload of volume and sets and like 5 days. And I think you're just doing 4 days and we're talking about not doing much more than like triples and 4s and everything is very light except the primary day.
And the secondary stays around like 88 to 90% of that primary load, not just on my 1RM. So if I'm doing like a 3 count single in the primary, it'll stay between that 88 to 90% of that 3 count. And then my tertiary is slightly less intense than the secondary. Like before, we used to front load the intensity throughout the week. So we'd have that primary day. Mm-hmm. And then we'd have 1 rest day. And then we'd have the secondary bench. And that secondary bench used to be so intense. Not as intense as the primary, but I'd be carrying so much fatigue that I'd feel it all the way until the primary because I had back-to-back high intensity days. So instead, we took that tertiary or that secondary, made it the tertiary, allocated some of the intensity and volume to the secondary now, and dispersed basically all that intensity throughout the week. So it's not just allocated in the front half anymore. Now it's actually dispersed. And then I just use my quaternary bench day as like just to touch the bar, basically. I keep that like 70, 75%. But I noticed that having the heavier exposure later in the week keeps me primed, but also more recovered. So I'm not cooking myself on the secondary or now the new tertiary.
So more like finding the exact dose you need on everything a single day instead of just blindly pushing everything.
Yeah. I like to keep the other days pretty sub max. I mean, the off season we'll push the secondary. Like for example, I'll give some free keys out right now exactly what we're doing, but we're doing mid grip 4s on the secondary bench, right? And we're gonna push that pretty intensely. It may go over RP9. We'll see. Actually, I really like to PR it. And since we're so far out from a meet, I'm okay with it leaking into the primary session. Like I'm 100% chill with that. Because I know if I push that and I'm doing my accessories and I'm getting more jacked, I'm getting bigger, I'll have more of a higher, you know, top end strength potential when I do go to peak for Sheffield. So that's the plan going forward.
And then, yeah, like we're okay with that. Like pushing the secondaries and all that super far out just because like we know we need to kind of take a little bit of a step back from, you know, reaching our peak intensity, especially after coming off back-to-back meets, like totaling 900 and then 890, all the travel and stuff. Joey's body pretty wrecked, so we want to stay away from that peak intensity on the primary, but then we induce a little limiting variation, like close grip 4s or mid grip 4s on the secondary to kind of hinder that top end strength that he can achieve on the primary.
I've heard from a secret source that you were away after Worlds for a bit. not wanting to get too specific on that, but Not without your permission. That was
no, it's okay. You good?
Okay, yeah, you were out on your honeymoon, right?
Yeah, in Madeira, Portugal. Yeah.
Oh, crazy good.
Nice.
Yes.
How did you handle the training there? Did you just cut it and say, "I'm not gonna touch a bar for this time"? But or how did you do it?
No, I didn't lift a weight from all the way until meet day or after meet day till I got home earlier this week on Sunday. So I didn't lift the weight for 11 days. So I got back and I was so detrained, but I feel pretty good now. Like everything right now is pretty sore. So my legs are clapped, my back, my chest, my delts, shoulders, everything is done right now. But I know with some good recovery, I'll be back into the swing of things very soon. But I haven't taken in more than like 3 days off in 8 years. So it's a well-deserved vacation for me.
Well, how did you feel with doing so? Like more than 3 days off training.
Oh, it felt very odd. Like, I'm used to like pushing my body in some sort of manner, but having just so much relaxation time was great. One thing I did notice is I was getting a lot smaller. I was like shrinking by the day. That's what it felt like.
Yeah, definitely, it's muscle. Everything muscle.
Like even my wife said it. She's like, "Yo, your biceps are like non-existent now." I was like, "Yeah, come on." And I wasn't eating. I wasn't eating enough either. Like the protein was down. Those were real down, and the calories are down. Like I dropped a bunch of weight. Like I'm sub 83 right now. So you have time to fill up.
You're telling me that you dropped weight on vacation?
Yeah. I force feed. So I'm like 80. Actually, no, today I woke up at over 83 again. We're good. We're 83.1.
Okay.
So we're blessed. So
you're more the maxi type of guy who needs to focus more on eating.
Yeah. I mean, now I mean,
he's all you can eat sushi.
All you can eat sushi after this. Yes, sir. I had that four times. I had it in Germany. I had it twice in Portugal. I'm going today. So it's amazing.
Yeah.
Sushi's my favorite food.
I mean, my wife's cooker is also full. But we got some nutrition questions, actually. Maybe it's a good time to chime in there. Conquest Powerlifting asked, what weight should I be sitting at a cut into the 74s? How would you cut into it? Water, etc.
Personally, when I was sitting at 75, I was 79.2. So I cut 4.2 kilos acutely within a week. For like 5 days. I wouldn't do it that extreme though, because it all depends on your current diet. So for example, I eat tons of fruits and vegetables. I have five fruits a day, or four fruits and a bunch of berries. And then I have a bunch of vegetables as well. So in total, I'm having at least 2 pounds of produce minimum. So if I gut cut, those 2 pounds or that 1 kilo automatically gone. So I have that leeway, but the average person is having, I don't drink any protein shakes instead of right now because I haven't had breakfast. So this is the only protein shake I've had in like 2 weeks, 3 weeks. But I don't drink any protein shakes. I don't eat any protein bars. Everything I have is high volume. So I know if I gut cut, like a true gut cut where I'm allocating more of my calories through liquid and high calorically dense foods, I drop an instant 2.5 kilos, like no issue whatsoever. Also, you throw in like a senna leaf laxative, that's another 0.5 kilo. And then you spit the rest. That's why I got to that 4 kilo mark. But the average person can't do that, like I said. So in this case, for 74, I wouldn't sit over like 76. And then you can, like I said, you can gut cut a kilo. I really wouldn't mess with the water intake because it's very easy to mess up, especially if you don't have a nutritionist.
No.
And personally, I've done a big water cut once, and that was the last time I ever did it. I was not doing that again. It was, I actually overcut too much. I went from like, it was the last meet at 74 when USAPL was 74 before the change, I went from like 76 to like 72. And I was like, oh, it was too severe. And I was like a raisin. I just didn't feel like my legs were under me. No matter how much sodium you had after the weigh-in, it just wasn't enough to recomp and hydrate. So water is something I don't mess around with. Like I'll still maintain like a good amount of water intake leading up until the day out. And I'll just cut it off 12 hours out from weigh-in. So if you weigh in at 10 a.m., cut your water off at 10 p.m. Maybe pull back sodium slightly. Let's say if you're having 4 grams, go to 3 grams, but something you just don't want to touch. And then I recommend just spitting my way down or spitting your way down. It's very easy. It's just slow and methodical. So it can get boring at first, but you find that groove, you sit down, watch an episode of whatever your favorite TV show is, watch a movie, and you just sit there with a cup and just spit, spit, spit. And I'm, I don't know why, but I can get around like a kilo in like an hour. Like I'm like a hyper responder to spit.
Not bad.
Like,
I
know, like I can get all my, like I get,
weird
I get
record. Like,
yeah. I tell all my athletes to do this method and they get around like half a kilo in an hour. So like, I'm like double the rate. I don't know why, but definitely give yourself some leeway. I recommend timing it out at intervals. That's what we do. Like we'll measure for 20 minutes, see how much we can spit, measure the grams, multiply by the amount of time we have left. But then also take into account that the amount of spit that you are, you know, spitting is going to decrease over the course of the hours. So I recommend just a gut cut, fasting, no food, 14 hours out, no water, 12 hours out, and just spitting your way down. And if you're 74, I think 76 should be perfect.
And then eat and rehydrate very fast after the weigh-in.
Yeah, I mean, I actually spit a little extra just so I can eat and drink in the morning. So I'll take like a shot of espresso, which is like 1 or 2 fluid ounces. I don't know if that is in milliliters, but look at this much of an espresso shot. I'll take that.
Mr. Coffee Expert Maxi.
Activate the metabolism a bit, get some energy in the body. And then I'll have a fuck ton of rice cakes. Each rice cake weighs around 10 grams. So I'll have like an entire pack of rice cakes, slam that down. That's like 500 calories, straight dried up rice. It weighs absolutely nothing. You can spit for like 20 minutes and make up the weight that you just ate for the entire rice cake pack. So it's like a recomp before the actual recomp after the weigh-in. So I would recommend that. Eating before weigh-ins, just spit a little more and make up that weight that way.
Yeah, I guess I'll just like say it's a lot of trial and error. Like Joey's been doing this for 4.5 years now. Like obviously he didn't start out with a 4.5 kilo cup from 79, you know, to 75. But like over time, we kind of just got better at the process. And then slowly we could say, okay, he could push this a little bit more, get a little heavier, and then we can gut cut a little bit more. But yeah, I wouldn't say, I would agree with Joe. Maybe if you're cutting down to 74, I'd say no more than 76, especially if you're just starting out. And I would honestly caution against doing water cut or gut cut in general. If you're just starting out, like sit at the weight or go up a weight class. There's no point really water cutting or gut cutting unless you're like trying to break a national record or something. Just go out there and like have fun. There's no point in capping yourself at a certain weight class, especially if you're so young. You have so much room to grow, especially from like a musculature standpoint. So yeah.
Yeah. The last option we didn't talk about, like that you don't need to go down, you can just stay there. And if you're not experienced enough with cutting down the weight class, then just don't. You don't need to. Usually you start out with federal meets where you don't have anything to win there. Just maybe get a qualifying total or something like that. Just go there, have fun, get your experience in, and then go for the next meet and maybe try it out there. Another question we were asking ourselves, because we are looking at high-level lifters in the world right now, more specifically, and we noticed that there is more or less two different camps of how to deal with nutrition every day. And there's, on the one hand, Megan Scanlon type of person tracking everything for 6 to 8, maybe 12 weeks. And there is the Emil Krastev kind of guy who tracks everything year round, no cheat meals. And they're both like top of the world. Where do you, Joe, see yourself there? What camp are you?
Since I moved up to 83, I'm way more relaxed with tracking calories. Like I'll still track, but if I want a cheat meal, I'll eat the cheat meal and I'll track it though. I'll put it in my app, but I don't care if let's say my macros are like 80, 90 grams of fat and the rest carbs and like 220 grams of protein. If one day I get 130 grams of fat because I had a slice of cake, I'm okay with that. I'm not going to kill myself over it. But most of the time I am pretty dialed in year round. But since I don't cut weight anymore, or I don't cut an actual like significant amount of weight anymore, I am definitely way more chill and I give myself way more leeway, because I was tracking when I was like 15 to like 21 pretty diligently. And that's just not out. The relationship I had with food just wasn't healthy enough, because everything I saw was just like, oh, protein, carb, fat, this, I don't care what it was. It was just straight up fuel. And I would be like, I'd be going to sleep thinking about my next meals because I was so hungry at night at 75, 74. So to be able to move up and just not be trashed all the time and not think about food and actually enjoy the meals I'm eating and not worrying about, oh, how much fat or protein's in this, then it just helps the mental so much more. And I can actually use that energy towards my training now. But I always track. I track every single day, year round. That's a non-negotiable for me. But if one day I don't eat enough carbs or protein, and I always get my protein, and that's 100%. Like protein 220 every day regardless. But if the fats or carbs are a little bit off here and there, I'm chill with it. If I have too much sugar one day, I'm chill with that. But as I get closer to the meat, I am more dialed. Like 12 weeks out, I'll be like 100% dialed in. Very limited on the cheat meals. But sushi, I eat sushi almost like every week. So that's one thing I'll let myself have. All you can eat sushi once a week and I'm chill. That's all I need.
But I think sushi isn't that bad. I mean, it's hard to track, I think, but...
I take a picture of a ChatGPT. I put it in there. I'm like, give me your best guess.
Oh, nice.
That's not accurate. It is what it is. But like, I make sure to only get like the raw rolls. So I'll have either tuna or like salmon with rice, no fried shit, none of that. I don't even like the way the fried stuff tastes. So I get the healthy rolls regardless.
Coming back to Luke, you told us about your...
studies.
What you're studying in med school. And maybe becoming a neurosurgeon there on the way. Do you think you are learning stuff like critical thinking or analyzing that helped you in powerlifting programming?
Absolutely. I would say, my studies and like coaching powerlifting are definitely like very mutually exclusive. What I will say, one thing that did help me out was like reading research papers. You really have, like, they're super dense, right? So you obviously have to be a very big critical thinker and a very good like critical reader as well. And so you have to recognize patterns while doing that. So the correlation between that and then also looking at Joey's training with all like the statistics, the graphs, like how they organize all their data, I guess like that's probably one of the only similarities that I could see. But yeah, they're definitely very distinct levels of study. But I mean, I don't know, I guess I could tap into the psychological aspect of like coaching Joey a lot more. Like with my degree in neuroscience, I feel like I can play a little bit more to his psychological side and like really pick and choose when like he can, like he's supposed to feel good, like give him certain levels of encouragement or like dopamine at certain times just to reinforce certain motor patterns or like that. But that's getting really into the nitty-gritty detail. But I mean, that's probably the only sector of my field that kind of helps me in powerlifting coaching would probably be like the pattern recognition and like diving into all the details of his training and statistics.
I find it interesting because I also think I really like to have a lot of metrics and try to make the data more visible, I guess.
Exactly.
What problem I see there, I know one or two coaches that get into the trap of too many data, overanalyzing and getting stuck in too many numbers. Do you notice it yourself or do you have a good limitation when to see any patterns when there aren't any?
Yeah, it's definitely hard. I know what you're saying, but yeah, I do try and really limit myself with all the data that I do track. I try and like stay away from all the nitty-gritty details like you were saying. Like I really just try and track all the things that matter the most. So it's just like total tonnage, like weekly frequency on each of the big three, like sets, reps, reps per set, absolute intensity on each day, you know, relative intensity, and as well as like a lot of the variation work. And then one other thing is just like estimated one rep max with like all of the video information that Joey shares with me, like doing the eye test and stuff just to see how fast things are moving. And then also from a, you know, numerical standpoint, what weights he's actually hitting. But yeah, it definitely is hard because you come in with these preconceived biases when you're coaching because you think that like, you know, all your future decision making is going to be correct. And so if you make this change, you're going to be programmed to try and see this result. And so it's really hard when, you know, you make that change and you think it's going to work out very well, but then it doesn't. Like, so for instance, one of the things, I've talked about this a little bit, I think on the like powerlifting programming podcast that you mentioned earlier, but it was like, I thought that recovery was a main issue for Joey's primary bench day. And so I front loaded volume and intensity way too hard. And that led to Joey feeling very recovered on the primary, but the weight felt very heavy in his hands and he wasn't very strong. So then, as Joey mentioned, we kind of backloaded intensity a little bit, evenly distributed volume more throughout the week. And turns out his bench got a lot better. And it was really hard for me to get out of that rut of like, he needs to be more recovered on this primary bench day, but that actually wasn't his real problem. So it definitely is very difficult, but I think like just realizing that you are not always correct as a coach and you make mistakes is the biggest thing for your athlete's success in the future.
And I heard about coaches that have never been wrong until now.
Except for yourself, right?
I'm a lot of times. But we have two questions about coaching. Since you are both coaching, I guess you
but,
can
But let's just throw that in. I think, Luke, you said on a podcast that you are not taking any further clients.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Yeah, unfortunately, so, no. I'd love to, and I've thought about it a lot. I really wrestle with it, but I can't.
So these questions, maybe just go to Joe. First one is, how much do you charge for coaching? So how's your model? How do you work with pricing?
So right now I have three coaching plans, all different price points. The first one is the lowest. It's at $120 a month. That is just programming only. No daily communication, but we have a recap call at the end of it. And that's where you send me your videos. And then we're going to be looking over the videos together, talking about the program, the new block coming in. So that's the first one, but there's no daily communication, like I said. And that's $120 a month. The second one is the tier above it. Daily communication over WhatsApp. Obviously the programming, but there's no monthly call because there's just so much daily communication and voice messages. So there's no monthly call. And then the last option is $200 a month. And that comes with daily communication program, of course, but that comes with also a monthly call. And those people that want the monthly call alongside with daily communication, we usually deep dive into other areas, not just their programming. So it's almost like I'm not going to say it's a mentorship call, but they'll be asking more in-depth powerlifting related questions that doesn't always have to do with what they're doing. So, because like I said, I do so many voice messages with my athletes. Like sometimes I'll have like a voice wall. Not everyone gets the monthly call, but not everyone wants it. Not everyone needs it. But then I also offer monthly calls to everyone. So you don't have to be my athlete to schedule a monthly call. So I offer that as well, but three tiers, 120, 170, 200. But I am going to bump it up shortly because right now I'm not accepting any athletes, but I will accept some, I think, starting in July. I'm going to add like three, maybe four more because I am at 30, but I cap at a 35. I like to maintain that 30, 35 mark for like the foreseeable future because as sponsors become more and more of my income, I don't have to invest or spread myself thin between all these athletes. Like I like to give a lot of time to each individual one. So like if I had like 50 people, like that would be just too much for me. Like I like to really prioritize each and every person and just make sure that we build an actual relationship and not just like, I'm your coach, do what I say. And that's it. Like, no, I don't like to run that way. I'm expanding slightly, but nothing crazy, nothing crazy.
Adding on to that, what's the average person in your coaching? Like, are they mostly beginners or intermediates, more professionals? What people do you work with?
Yeah, so it ranges everyone from like straight up beginner. I'm not sure, like I can give you like GL points or not GL. I know dots, I know GLs, but the average, I think I did the math earlier. The average is like a 450 dot. So pretty, like slightly above average, I'd say, right?
Solid. That's pretty solid. Yeah.
Yeah, so nothing, but no world champs just yet. I do have a guy going to NAPFs. He has like 530 dot. He's pretty strong. He's one of my strongest athletes. And then I have a bunch of them that are around that 480, 490, 500. And then the rest are like I said, 450, maybe south of that. And I have a very handful of beginners. I try to stay away from that, but I do accept some now and then because it does keep you sharp. It helps you like really take a step back and understand the absolute basics again. So I like to, maybe take one beginner every now and then, but majority of the guys I take are like true intermediates trying to like qualify for nationals or maybe the step above that. So,
I mean, you already talked about your calories and macros.
Yeah. Not the exact amount, but yeah.
You can also share your macros if you want.
Right. Okay, all right.
One specifically asked about that.
All good. Let me pull it up. I try to sit around 3,300 calories, 220 to 230 grams of protein, 400 grams of carbs, and 90 fat. That is what I have right now.
So here we go.
But I'm okay if the fat goes a little higher and the carbs go a little lower. I'm chill with that. As long as I get like at least 100 grams of carb before my training session, that's pretty much all I need to feel good.
If I understand it correctly, difference between 4-3-2-1s before a comp versus ascending RPE singles. I don't think he's talking about blocks. Maybe he's talking about the weeks leading up to the comp.
Oh, no, I think he's talking about the actual macro itself, like going from sets of 4 to sets of 3 to sets of 2 to sets of 1 versus going like RP, like 7 single, 1 block, 8 single, 9 single,
and
then meet day.
Yeah, maybe this.
So ascending to static RPE per block, I would say. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, the rep schemes would be changing. Those would be the variable change, but the RP would be static in that scenario from block to block.
Yeah, right.
Well, if they're asking the difference, that's the difference. But if they're asking the why, mm-hmm. it all depends on the other days and like their coach's philosophy. In my opinion, I'm not a fan of the year-round single. I don't have to be strong every block, and I'm okay with that. Plus, I truly enjoy the feeling of PRing every single block. And you're not going to be able to PR every single block if you're just running single after single after single. But if I do a set of 4, when's the last time I did a set of 4? 6 months back. So the next time I do one, I'm PRing that. And then same thing with triples and same thing with doubles, same thing with singles. The momentum I build personally from that I guess you'd call it drop step every block for the macro. I personally enjoy that. I like the objective momentum that I'm seeing block after block versus just running singles and just progressing through like volume changes on the back downs. But it all depends on your coach's philosophy and what they believe is right for you. Some people need the year-round single. Like for bench, for example, we are experimenting with the year-round single. However, there's a huge caveat. It changes from block to block in terms of variation and also in terms of priority. So right now we are running a 3-count fatigue single. So we're running four volume sets and then 1 3-count fatigue single. I don't know if Luke wants me to give the keys away. You're smiling a little too much.
No, it's fine. You can go ahead.
All right. So I'll give you like three of my blocks. I'll give you the macro, for example. So we're doing a fatigue 3-count right now. Next block, we'll do a fatigue 2-count. The block after, we are doing a semi-fatigue 2-count. So we're doing 1 volume, 2-count single, and then the rest of the back downs instead of doing all the volume first and then the back down. And the final block of the macro, we're just simply doing top set, comp single this time. So semi-fatigued comp single, and then the rest of the back downs. So you notice I'm doing singles throughout the entire macro, but they change from a 3-count super fatigue, 2-count super fatigue, 2-count semi-fatigue to comp semi-fatigue. So that's the bench progression we are looking for. And as you notice, it gets more and more comp specific. Also, we strip away fatigue prior to that single. So we're going to have objective load increases from block 4, 3, 2 to 1. So that's the go-to right now.
Did you in the past do like triples, double singles on bench and it didn't work out?
Yeah, we did it last offseason and my bench felt like shit. Like because my rep work is so, my rep work in terms of like intensity is so distant from my single work. Like you can plug it into like a 1RM calculator, which I don't like to do, but it could give you some sort of viewpoint. And if you put like my 1RM of like 218, it spits back a triple at 205. No shot I'm doing a 205 triple. I maybe get like 2 reps. But
no.
That's the reason I don't like to do the top sets. I mean, I will do a top set with rep work. Like for example, like I said, I'm going to do a top set single then back down work. But I like to keep the year-round intensity on that bench and not stray away too much. Like I don't want to not have to touch over or under 200 kilos for an entire macro. Like, and that's what's going to happen if I just do rep work straight through with no singles. I won't be able to go over 200, and yet my max is 215, 220, right? So I like to keep the year-round singles now. We tried it. We tried the rep work initially last offseason, but then we transitioned directly to the more hyper-specific single work, and we noticed immediately that my bench took off right when we started getting singles. It took off so much that we decided to do singles on the tertiary and secondary bench day on the last block of the macro before the meet. And it worked amazing. Like my bench loves low intensity or low rep work, high intensity volume. So like the lower the reps for me, for example, like the stronger I feel on bench. And then I just get more of my volume or high rep work through accessories. And that's what I used to grow. My accessory work is my growth work, basically. And I don't really touch over, maybe deep in the off season, I'll touch a set of six on bench. But as I get closer to a meet, everything's like fours and belows.
Yeah, I think we know it's the same thing with keeping in the singles, doing more high intensity or some high intensity work on every day. It doesn't have to be very high on every day. We also combine it with more high rep set and volume, but it totally makes sense if you don't perform as good on volume that you switch to accessory, which is, I guess, not that fatiguing and you can
exactly
push it much easier.
And the accessory is a lot easier to progress, in my opinion, because like right now I'm doing like a incline barbell bench, which is highly fatiguing. I think it's the it's the most fatiguing accessory, in my opinion, for the chest. But then next macro, I'll transition to like a dumbbell incline, and then I'll transition to a flat dumbbell. So the accessory itself becomes more specific and less fatiguing over the course. And the same thing with like shoulder work. I'll do like a barbell shoulder to a dumbbell shoulder to a machine shoulder. And I'm prioritizing recovery the closer I get to the meet day, but I'm doing less specific, more intense, and more fatiguing work earlier in the off season.
And you mentioned you did dips in the past, but dropped them because they were too fatiguing.
Yes,
but we are big fans of dips right now, so we need to know how much did you dip.
I was dipping, I know for sure, over four reds. For sure, it was like four reds for an easy like seven or eight reps. But
no, that's not bad.
I might have touched five reds.
Fatiguing, yeah.
Yeah, I might have touched five reps or five reds for maybe like a triple before. I'm not sure, but I'd for sure four reds for multiple reps. And I did that initially because we dropped frequency from four times to three times on bench. And I was like, well, I got to fill in the gap somehow. I'm going to just push the shit out of these dips. And it worked. And my bench got, it went up. But then we added that fourth bench day back in, and I was just fried. I was cooked. So I decided to just drop it and sub it out for like an incline dumbbell. And I noticed my fatigue just dropped so much more. And I was feeling way stronger in the primary.
So one question, I think you can both answer this. What do you think will come with the next year? Is there a limit for you, or when do you think your progress will slow down? And what are the biggest rivals or threats at Sheffield and the next Worlds?
So I'll answer the back half of that question first and let my coach attack the first half. So my biggest threat at Sheffield, probably Perk. Anthony McNaughton as well, like, because he's a beast. But I think I can out progress Perk and meet him at his top end. So I think right now Perk has like maybe 865, 870. I think it's 5 for 9, first of all. It was like a pseudo 5 for 9. He didn't have that many more kilos left than that, in my opinion. Okay. Like his squat probably had like 7 more, bench had like 2.5, and his deadlift probably had 20. So it's a pseudo 5 for 9. You can take your thirds as openers and say I went 3 for 3 and call it the best performance ever, right? But in my opinion, I think his top end's like 865, maybe 870. So by then, I'm assuming 880 is what's going to be his absolute perfect super meet at Sheffield, 880. And I did the math already. I'm going to need like 930 to 935. And I believe with my progress, I can reach that. I kind of like Jim Broed my way into that number too. Like, so for example, like at Nationals, I did
10Ks on bench.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I did 900 at Nationals. If everything went right at Worlds, I had 910, right? So all I need is 20 more kilos in 7 months. That's easy, right?
I mean, it's crazy that you do 890 with being sick the weeks before.
Exactly. And Worlds isn't meant to be like the atmosphere or environment to have the best meet. Because first of all, it was so hot in that venue. It was insane. Like dripping sweat nonstop in that venue. I don't know why there's no air conditioning. But yeah, like I think by Sheffield, if everything goes right, I clearly have a lot of room to grow. I have at least 3 kilos of body weight I can slap on my frame right now. So with that new body weight, with all that time, 7 months, because between Raleigh and Nationals, I added 35 kilos. Now I have the exact same time frame between Worlds and Sheffield. So if all I have to do with that is 30 now, drop that progression to 5 kilos. But have even more body weight to gain, I think is for sure on the table. Plus, I want to break some of the records. I want the bench world record and the deadlift. The deadlift is 380. or 380.5. I have pulled that in the gym already. So I think with a proper peak and some more momentum, I have that for sure. Bench is like 218.5. That's the record. I for sure have, I've done 220 in the gym. It was like touch and go. So I'm not really going to count that. But by then, I think I have it. And then squat, I'm not touching that squat record. I'm okay with it. I don't fucking care. But if I could touch like 315, 320 by then, that would be a blessing. But I think for sure I can rival Perk. And then Anthony McNaughton, we'll see with him. He's for sure, I think, the strongest 105 ever. Definitely rivals the 120s, unless you count Rondell, but he's not in the IPF at the moment. But with his progression, I think he can be a pretty good rival. But Perk is the main guy, like I said. And I think I can catch him at the peak by January 31st at Sheffield.
It's so amazing to see you guys pushing the limit. The last PA Nets was a moment in our coaching where we told each other, okay, we need to step our game up. Something is happening there. Yeah, and sure. That's not the limit. We need to get better at coaching and create even better athletes.
Yeah, well, a secondary goal I actually do have real quick before Luke takes over is I want to beat the 93s at Sheffield. That's the next goal.
I don't know. Yeah. Would it be set hard?
What was Emil doing? Was it 9:30?
Emil's not doing 9:30. He did 9:17 at Sheffield.
Yeah, what did he do to win Worlds?
9:10. Or 9:12, something like that.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's not that far off.
Okay, sorry, wasn't having that in mind.
And not, like, humbly speaking, my progression is objectively faster than everyone right now. So I will bank on that, and I'll bank on my coach to get me right that we're going to show up even stronger.
Yeah, also not hating on the 93s, but when we had all, like, preview meetings on the Worlds, we were noticing that, okay, the difference between the 83s and the 93s isn't that big.
It's not, no.
And let's see, not even if, when it's going to happen that Joe is going to beat the 93s at any competition. Doesn't matter if it's Sheffield, but crazy, crazy progress. Yeah, back to Luke. You are the guy who has to answer now. Where's the limit? When does it stop?
How far can you push him?
How far can he go?
I mean, I definitely think there's obviously a limit, but like, I don't think it's anywhere close. I don't think we're there yet, to be honest. Like, it's every off season that Joey has where we have like 7 or 8 blocks, we always normally add around 35 kilos to the total. And it was pretty crazy because like, we had Raleigh, and then I think 3 or 4 blocks later, he hit 885 on a deload. So, I mean, you could say he probably had more on the day. So that was like 20, 25 kilos, probably in like 4 blocks. And then like, I think a block or two after that, he hit 900. So there's like 35 kilos already in like 6 blocks. And I don't, like, we were doing so much volume with that 900 as well. Like, we were doing very heavy, you know, back down work and secondary stuff. So yeah, I mean, I think give us a good off season and we'll replicate what we've done in the past. But yeah, like, I mean, I can't see us stopping right now, really. I mean, yeah, like we know it works, and like we've gotten so much better. Like we just get better every single off season. Like both Joey's a lifter, then me as a coach, we always just, you know, do those slight little optimizations that end up paying off huge dividends when, you know, meet day comes forward. And like Joey was really nerfed with the back to back meets. So like our 2 block macro cycle leading into Worlds. As Joey mentioned, that first block back was like huge. You know, we were scheduled to hit 9:10, 9:15. You know, we were on pace with that 870 for reps, and then Joey got sick. So I think that our top end is a little bit higher than what was shown at Worlds, and then give us another, you know, 7 block off season. I think we'll be there to rival Perk. Obviously, right now Perk is definitely in the driver's seat, and it will be an uphill battle. But I do think we are definitely capable of pushing him, and, you know, obviously winning.
And with the absolute loads getting higher and higher, is there anything you do in terms of programming to improve or keep his resilience against these high loads? I mean, no matter if you push the single or the triple at the end, it looks like a pretty hard grind. So I can imagine that took a toll on the body. Is there anything, are you making your thoughts about it, or is it just like load progression and keeping everything in check?
Well, so I want to preface my answer by saying that like the 900 was not programmed, the 885 was not programmed. So like a lot of these high intensity days weren't actually on the program. But what I will say though is like with that, when we do touch very high intensity, you know, we wave load the volume just to make sure that his fatigue is in check for the following block. So he's not like too in the gutter and can't get out of it for the next week's four. And then also like we do take like very big jumps, you know, as we were saying earlier in that, like starting the week one super low really helps his recovery. He doesn't get too detrained from that, which is very good. But just having those very big jumps from like the week one to four also really helps us manage fatigue from that peak intensity standpoint.
So mostly load management and fatigue management.
Mm-hmm. And then also like having the primary SPD day be like on one day, obviously just with the SPD, it really helps us with like the fatigue management throughout the block, but then also throughout the week. So we kind of just stagger a lot of our fatigue on one certain day, and then we can recover a lot more throughout the week versus having primaries like every two or three days. If that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. I find it hard to do SPD days or primary SPD days even with some of my athletes. I mean, I think good leverages with sumo deadlifts helps.
For sure.
Don't know so much people who are doing SPDs or primary SPDs with conventional, but can you recover until deadlift? I've heard your primary sessions go very long sometimes.
Yeah, that's the only reason. Like personally, I do not recommend a primary SPD to like 99% of lifters. Like none of my athletes, I have over 30 athletes, none of them want it. So I think it's super rare. And if your whole life is allocated towards this sport and you're optimizing every little thing and you have the genetics and you have the leverage, like I think at that point you can try it out as an experiment, right? But how many people can actually spend an entire day at the gym? Because my week four SPD is going to take me hopefully less than 7 hours this time, but we'll see. Like it takes me an entire day because you have to consider like the warm-up routine. I time every single warm-up. I time every back down. I get at least 10 minutes of rest between back downs. And then I take 20 minutes of rest between each lift. So I don't go from squat right to bench. I rest for a little bit. I'll eat some food. I'll rehydrate. So if I have, let's say, four sets of squat, five sets of bench, 39 sets, and four of deadlift, that's 13 total sets, at least 130 minutes worth of rest time, not including any of my warm-ups yet, not including any of the breaks between the lifts yet. So right there, that's over 2 hours just from straight up resting between the sets. So not taking into account the actual warm-up and everything, like it's a very hefty session, but I bring enough food with me, enough hydration, and I just enjoy it. It feels like I'm clocking in for work and I got a job to do.
Yeah, like a literal work day.
Yeah, it makes the SPD days, or it makes meet days, so much easier, because now like I can just do one single on squat and I'm like, okay, no back downs, bet. I'll just go to my bench now, PR. You know what I mean? Like it feels so much better on meet day compared to training, because there's not all that volume cooking me before bench and especially before deadlift, because my deadlift is always stronger on meet day regardless. Because I'm not sure if you saw my, was like 357 or 355 last single in prep. It moved like ass. I probably had 10 kilos more, 365, and then I ended up pulling 372 on meet day. Same thing with nationals prep. I did 357. I ended up pulling 377 on meet day. So just by stripping those back downs away, I'm able to express my top end so much better. I think primary SPDs work great for me. I've been able to navigate my life around it, thankfully, but the average person I'd still recommend it. They cannot handle it.
You are probably right about that. We want to close the show with a final question, also look into the future beyond Sheffield. Is there anything you want to do when you quit powerlifting? Is there a chance you will? Or is there a plan B when everything is done?
Equipped powerlifting? Was that the question?
No, when you quit. So when you finished
with powerlifting. What is that?
No, I'm not doing equipped, sorry.
I'm so sorry.
I'm a squat suit.
No. So when you're done with powerlifting, what's the plan?
I'll be dead because I'm not going to be done with powerlifting for the rest of my life. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's the only correct answer you could give.
I mean, there would be a that's point where like too, I'm man. Just not competing. Yeah, I'll be master lifter by then. But I do want to.
I'm kicking all the records, bro.
Yeah, well, but once I'm not in the open anymore, and like I'm like I don't know, 50 or 60, whatever the case is, I'll allocate more of my time to like give back to the sport and like be like a full time ref. Even by then, hopefully IPF pays their refs or something. They fly them out and take care of them, yeah. Right? I know. Hey, powerlifting. I think it will grow to the point 40 years where it's going to be there, but. Yeah, hopefully by then I can just like give back and just be full on one with the community and just do the best I can when I'm, you know, 60, 70 years old. Hopefully I'll be lifting though. That'd be great. If my knees work, my hips work and all that, and I'm able to get under the barbell, then thanks be to God, because that'd be a huge blessing, man.
So with that, we're closing the show for today. A very, very, very big thank you to Luke and Joe for being on the show, giving us all the super detailed insight. We're really thankful for that. Yeah, and we're gonna let you go to get your sushi, Joe.
Yes sir.
If you have anything else to say, please do so. Otherwise, yeah, thanks for listening to everybody, and we'll have you on the show next week for everyone else. And yeah, hopefully maybe get another episode in with you two guys, because there are some questions for me that I want to ask in the future. And let's see how Sheffield's going to work. Much success for you, and see you there.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you very much.
Falk, I'll see you at our next primary SPD session.
Yeah, for sure.
take the day off, please. Yeah.
Yes, sir.